Candidates Bree Kidman and Eric Brakey make their case for your vote. Today we wrap up 3 days of primary candidate interviews. On July 14th, Democratic voters will choose between three candidates to challenge Susan Collins in November. And Republican voters will choose between three candidates to challenge Jared Golden in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Today, we have one from each group. I'm Jennifer Rooks. For the first half hour, we will talk with Bree Kidman, an attorney and self-described Democratic socialist who is running for Senate. In the second half hour, former state senator and state director for the Ron Paul campaign, Eric Brakey. What do you want to know about the candidates' priorities and positions on the issues? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. My guest this half hour is Bree Kidman, a criminal defense attorney who is running for the Democratic nomination for the United States Senate. Bree, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
As always, we want to hear from you. Here is your chance to ask a question of one of the candidates. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Bree, why are you running for U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I mean, well, the first reason that I'm running is that I'm qualified. I have an understanding of the law. I went to law school. I graduated magna cum laude. I've worked in federal and state policy. And so I've worked with the law an awful lot. And I didn't think that I was ever going to run for office. I thought that, you know, people like me don't become politicians. You know, you have to be a certain kind of person to be a politician. But after having a series of unsatisfying interactions with Susan Collins' office and attempts to kind of reach her and engage with my representation, I started thinking, why not me, though? Why not someone like me? And, you know, the reasons that I kind of boiled down to at the end of it, the one reason that really stuck out was that I'm a median income Mainer. Who doesn't have access to a network of wealthy people to fund my campaign. And, you know, that's not a good enough reason. If the only reason that I'm not, you know, not a politician, not someone who should be in the Senate, is that that I don't have access to the money to run, well, that speaks more to a problem with the system. So I started looking more into our political system and our candidate selection process, and came to find that, you know, media coverage tends to focus on how much money a person has, and that is determinative of who's the front runner or who's going to win the race. And I thought, well, that's buying an election. And so I started asking people all over the state, you know, how many people think that you can buy an election? And half to all of every room I've been in has said, yeah, you can buy an election. And I asked, how many people think you should buy an election? And so far, after talking to, you know, thousands of people at this point, I've seen one hand, and I talked to that person after. And they said, oh, no, that's not what I meant. You shouldn't buy an election. So the short version, the kind of one sentence version, is I believe it's time to change the process and that we need someone who hasn't benefited from the process to do that. Because if you won using the process, there's no incentive to change it.
If elected, what would be your number one priority, your number one issue come 2021?
I mean, yeah, my number one issue is process reform. My number one issue is finding ways to make sure that our representation is more representative. But there are so many issues on the table, and I think that they're all kind of interconnected. You know, a big one is Medicare for all. No industry which makes its profit off of making sure we get as little health for our dollar as possible has any right to exist in this country. Like, you look at that and you think about it that way, it's predatory to make sure that, you know, you get as much money as possible for making sure we're not getting health care. That's not a health care system. So taking the profit motive out of health care and, you know, making sure it's a single payer solution so that the United States is able to negotiate on behalf of the people and get the best deal for the American people, that's really, really important to me. And I think that that spills over into other areas of policy. Like, if you get a healthcare solution that addresses healthcare issues for everyone, that starts to address other things like mass incarceration and criminal justice reform. Like, as a criminal defense attorney, you know, I interact with most of my clients are people who can't afford a lawyer. And most of the people that I interact with, by a large, large margin, are there because of mental health issues, substance abuse issues, poverty, or some combination of the above. And so when you address things like getting treatment for mental health issues, getting treatment for addiction issues, not having healthcare debt, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, causes of bankruptcy in the United States today, all of a sudden these things that kind of become crimes of necessity, crimes of the next right thing to do, those things start to go away and we have fewer people incarcerated. So we're not paying for the cost of incarceration. We're not paying for the cost of courts or lawyers. We have that money back in the system and more people become taxpaying workers and get back into kind of meaningful participation in contributing to our shared resources. The other piece is the Green New Deal. When I think about climate change, it's not as much about what we do as how we do it, because we all know that we're going to have to transition to green energy. I think it's kind of commonly accepted that we are going to have to eventually find a way to do this, and sooner rather than later. But when I think about the transition to green energy, something that's really important to me is making sure that we're not using kind of piecemeal Band-Aid solutions that don't address the whole. This isn't an issue that can be dealt with state by state or even country by country. This has to be dealt with holistically. Like, as a globe, we have to reduce emissions. And so I have concerns that existing energy companies will kind of pounce on this as an opportunity to greenwash and make themselves look good by enacting these kind of piecemeal solutions that might do a little bit or might not even have any reduction at all, but sound good. And I think we have to make sure that we are centering the net reduction. And also, it's an opportunity. Having a crisis like this, is obviously very scary, but also it presents an opportunity for America to get at the forefront of innovation, for us to be an innovator in an industry when we haven't really had kind of that that manufacturing innovation stance in the world for some time now. And so we can get at the forefront of this, and we can also use this as an opportunity to create economic justice where there hasn't been some, where people have been left behind in the past, where we can center economically depressed communities, where we can center people who have been marginalized and maybe left out of previous innovative solutions to problems, and create good, good paying jobs, and create new technology that's going to solve this problem at the same time.
We're talking with Democratic candidate for Senate Bree Kidman. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can also send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. I'll go to Tony, who's calling from Guilford. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
How are you ladies today?
Good.
Hey, I'm just wondering, as a national stance, like Governor Ralph Norman from Virginia, he supports like killing babies after they're born as part of like an abortion. Is that something you agree with? Like, if a baby survives abortion, killing it after it's born, like actually out of the womb and laying on the table?
Tony, thanks for your question. It is a different question than you told our producer you'd be asking. Would you like to ask about the coronavirus as well?
No, I assume that she's not going to want to answer that question, is she?
Bree, it's up to you. Go ahead.
So I'm not familiar with any abortion healthcare procedure that involves killing a live birth. That's not something that I think I've heard about, and I have worked, for Planned Parenthood. I was a policy intern there, and I was also a patient greeter helping protect patients' access to care. And so I don't know if I understand your question, because I don't think that that's a practice that actually takes place in this country.
Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam supports killing babies that survive abortions after they're born alive.
Okay, well, so Bree has answered your question. She's involved in this issue and has never heard of this before. So I appreciate your call, Tony. We're going to go to a question from Felix on Facebook. Felix asks, what is your stance on the CMP Maine corridor?
Yeah, I'm against the CMP corridor for a number of reasons. As I was talking about the Green New Deal before, I think I talked about some of them, where I think it's a corporate solution that's designed to kind of maximize profit, but doesn't do a whole lot in terms of net reduction. I'm concerned about the amount of money that went into blocking kind of a net impact. Right? I don't think we have enough data about what the net impact is. I don't think we necessarily have data showing that it is a net reduction in carbon. emissions. I'm also concerned about the sort of tribal sovereignty issues associated with it and the way that it would impact tribal lands. I'm also concerned about the environmental impacts of hydropower and the way that that may not necessarily be, a long-term sustainable green power solution after all. So I don't think it's a good proposition. I think that, it's one of those things where it's easy to say that you are doing something green, and it's easy to say that you're doing, cleaner power because it involves water and natural resources. But I think it's more important to really drill down into what the net impact is and, whether that creates long-term jobs for Mainers and whether that creates a long-term, reductions in emissions. And I don't think we have enough data on that yet. I think, if we had that data, if we had more information about what the net impact would be, if we had a solution that protected tribal sovereignty, I wouldn't necessarily be entirely opposed, but I think that as it stands now, it's sort of a rush job.
We have an email here from Carl. Maine is a state with one of the oldest populations in the country. As such, seniors already spend on average $1 out of $6 on health care. There is already talk on Capitol Hill of the need to cut back on some of the programs that Maine's seniors rely upon. If elected, what steps will you take to protect Medicare from benefit cuts?
Yeah, I mean, I'm for Medicare for all, and I don't think that necessarily represents Medicare as it stands now. It's an improved Medicare that covers all of our health care costs, and that's, for seniors all the way down to kids. And so I believe that it is a government's responsibility to make sure that our basic human rights are protected. I include health care among basic human rights. And I think an important thing to add, I think particularly with regard to Medicare and costs, is prescription drugs, because I know that prescription drug costs are kind of one of those things that, my grandmother, when she was on Medicare, really struggled with. And so in the Medicare for All bill that that I've spent the most time with, and that I think is the Sanders proposal, there is an out-of-pocket cap of $200 per family per year. Now, I think that cap could be more responsive to income levels. If someone looks at $200 and says that's way beyond, what I can afford in a year, or some people could say, I could pay a little bit more than that. I think we could kind of make caps like that more responsive to what individuals and families are able to pay into the system. But I don't think that a healthcare solution that leaves people going bankrupt to get healthcare is a solution. I think that that's another problem. And so, one of my biggest priorities is making sure that people aren't making choices about finances when they're thinking about how to stay alive in terms of healthcare.
Bree, you mentioned you're a criminal defense attorney. One of the big conversations right now is about criminal justice reform. I would like to know what you believe needs to happen in terms of criminal justice reform and racial disparities within the criminal justice system.
Yeah, so the first thing I want to say is that Black Lives Matter. And so in looking to movement leaders, and I believe it's really important when we consider any solution to any problem, when we talk about any kind of social issue, I think it's really important that we listen to the people who are most directly impacted, and we center the voices of people who are closest to the issue, and then take what they say and put that into action. I don't think that it's my job as a politician to substitute my judgment for what people who are closest to the issue say that they need. And so the thing that people have been saying that they need is defund the police. And I think that that's a scary set of words for a lot of people to hear. My dad's been a police officer for over 30 years, and we've had a lot of conversations over the last few years and even more over the last month or so. But when we talk about defunding the police, I think that what that looks like in practice is a way to transition away from using the police to address every social ill. Right now, if you have a mental health crisis where someone is not safe, or if you have someone overdosing, you call the police and someone goes to jail. And that's not a solution that gets anyone anywhere. It doesn't get anyone out of the circumstances that brought them to the problem to begin with. And if you talk about defunding the police, what we're really talking about is funding social services adequately so that we're not sending a sledgehammer to deal with a scalpel issue. What if we could call a crisis team 24/7 who are prepared to deal with escalated mental health issues but weren't armed, weren't going to criminalize someone, and could get them connected to resources? What if you had somebody who was overdosing, you could, call a mental health professional or call a healthcare professional rather, and not have to worry about them going to jail for having drugs. You know, I think the fear that comes with being criminalized is multifold. And then, you know, in terms of the racial justice issues, you know, in the House today, they're talking about a bill that bans chokeholds. And they're talking about that as though it's some kind of solution, and it's going to get batted back and forth between the left and the right, like it's the be all end all. And the truth is, when Eric Garner was killed, chokeholds weren't allowed by the New York Police Department. You know, these kinds of solutions don't address the underlying issue. So I think when we approach this issue, we need to really look at, you know, are we looking at Band-Aids, or are we looking at you know, a more systemic cure? So that's kind of the way that I approach the framework. I'm trying to think if there's more specific things. I mean, one is certainly making sure that police don't have access to military-grade equipment. You know, there's no reason that municipal police forces need tanks and Bearcats and, you know, military equipment. You know, these things aren't necessary for day-to-day law enforcement, and I struggle to see a situation where they would need them. We have a military to use those things. Qualified immunity is certainly one where we need to stop that practice. I think the biggest thing is making sure that we have solutions that are responsive to the problem. I think for a long time we've asked police to do things that aren't really their job, aren't really their training, aren't really their experience. And I think that is, it's tough to detach from that because that's the way we've always conceptualized our society to be. But I think we're at a point now where we're being asked to think of something better. And I think that we need people who are ready to rise to that moment. You know, if we could train implicit bias away, it would have been trained away by now. You know, it's not like there aren't implicit bias trainings. It's just that it's not working. It's not enough. We need leaders who are ready to meet the moment and think of something better.
We'll go to John, who's calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi, Bree. Been following your campaign with great interest. You're doing an interesting job. The question I had is, all three of the candidates are from Southern Maine, and where everything feels so divided lately, how do you speak to people who feel like, you know, how are you going to represent the entire state? What is your experience with, you know, beyond the Southern Maine needs and questions?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. So I have been all over the state over the course of this campaign. I personally drove to every county in my little subcompact and talked with people all over the state. Although I do live in Southern Maine, one of the kind of central messages or focuses of my kind of political theory, my approach to things, is that I think it's important that we center the voices of people who get left behind. I think that a lot of, rural Maine, a lot of people kind of outside the Portland metro feel like they get left behind by politicians, like nobody cares, like nobody's listening, like nobody's paying attention. And that's the exact kind of thing that I want to fight. I want to find a way to make meaningful civic engagement possible. And I want to find a way to make sure that people who get left behind are represented adequately and are heard. I think, you know, while it's tough that I live in Saco, which is, you know, almost as far south as you can get, you know, over the course of this campaign up until coronavirus hit, I have really been walking the walk or driving the drive to talk with people all over the state, and I don't expect that to change. You know, if I'm elected, I've committed to holding a town hall in every county every year. To make sure that I am getting to people all over the state, listening to what they have to say, and setting up a constituent services team that that is ready to be not just listening, but responsive to people's concerns to make sure that I'm getting kind of the full picture of what people need from me.
John, thanks for your question. Bree, I want to ask you about the other big issue of our day, which is COVID-19 and how so many governors and the president and members of Congress are trying to figure out the balance between public health and economic health. What are your thoughts? What are your reflections on where we are in terms of our response to COVID-19 and where we need to head next?
I am I am afraid of what happens next because we're seeing numbers rise all over the country. I don't know what that's going to look like in Maine, you know, as we have kind of a tourism-based industry. And I'm not unsympathetic to the fact that, you know, these are our highest earning months in a lot of parts of Maine. Certainly, you know, near where I live, this is where a lot of Mainers kind of make their income for the year. That said, you know, if we're having tourism from a lot of other states, we're not, you know, really enforcing the quarantine protocols at all. Like, are we going to see an uptick in cases? And that's something that is worrisome to me. And as we see a resurgence in other states that may or may not hit Maine at the same level, you know, we have people who are having to go back to work because unemployment is going to end at the end of July, the pandemic unemployment insurance, and people are going to have to start making decisions about, you know, whether they prioritize their health and their safety, or whether they prioritize, you know, having the money that they need to live. And so I think that those decisions are ones that that ideally we shouldn't have to make. You know, with the relief packages that have been released in the last few months, the figure that I read most recently, and I'm not sure if that's entirely accurate, but that corporations got $38,000 per capita, meaning that it would be cheaper to give every American person or American family $20,000 and call it a day. And so I think that the problem is multifold, right? We want to get back to work, and we want to make sure that people are doing the things that they do to feel like they have purpose in the world and are making income, but also the money is always there for corporate bailouts. The money is always there to make sure that millionaires and billionaires have what they need, but it's not always there for us. And by and large, it's our tax money. We're paying higher tax rates than, you know, the middle class are paying higher tax rates than the people who have more resources. So I think solutions going forward really need to focus on making sure that average American families are getting our needs met and are not having to make choices about, you know, whether I go back to work and put my health at risk, you know, in a situation where it could be at risk, or whether I have food on the table. I think we need to make sure that people are provided for and able to make those choices based on their health and safety.
Bree, one of the state's largest employers, Bath Iron Works, is in the midst of a strike by its largest unit of its union. And wondering what your thoughts are on the Bath Iron Works strike, and if there is a role. If you were a U.S. senator, what would your role be in responding to it?
Yeah, so I'm 100% in solidarity with the Essex. You know, I was at a meeting of the Southern Maine Labor Council and got to hear a little bit about the issue with subcontractors. My understanding of the strike is that there are kind of two main pushes, and one is the healthcare costs, and the other is the use of subcontracted labor and kind of a lack of restrictions or the reduction of restrictions on Bath Iron Works from using that labor. And so I feel like a broken record because I keep saying this, but Medicare for all, you know, one of the arguments against that is that union labor, you know, wants to keep their health plans. But as we see, you know, this strike kind of illustrates the fact that, well, union labor is having to fight for their health plans in contract negotiations over and over and over again. And if healthcare was taken care of, if we all had high quality healthcare as a base, you know, kind of entry point into being an American, that wouldn't be something that they would have to negotiate for anymore. That's one thing that they don't have to worry about anymore, and it provides more leverage in negotiations for things like, you know, like dealing with the subcontractor issue. And so the subcontractor issue is, you know, I can only imagine how frustrating that must be, because basically it's a company saying, well, you know, we want to take care of some of these issues without having to pay for union labor. We don't want to have to treat our workers with the respect that they deserve. We don't want to have to treat our workers to the benefits that they've earned. I don't know. I'm trying to think if there's anything that I could do as a senator offhand about that. But I mean, ultimately, I think, you know, creating more leverage to the point where workers can say, well, we're not gonna allow for that. You know, you have to choose. You know, you can't have one foot in and one foot out. You can't say that you're a good union company while also throwing the union to the dogs every time you want to find somebody cheaper to do the job.
Bree, Bree Kidman, you've called yourself a Democratic Socialist and said that you support the Green New Deal. Do you have any principles? Are there any issues with which you disagree with others who describe themselves as Democratic Socialists and support the Green New Deal, with Bernie Sanders, for example?
So that's tricky, because I feel like, you know, Democrats are a big tent, and so are Democratic Socialists. You know, people come at this from people come at politics from a number of different backgrounds, a number of different experiences, a number of different perspectives. And so I don't really know how to differentiate myself from the Democratic Socialist movement, because ultimately there are so many different ideologies in there anyone, you know, you could draw out of a hat and I could kind of go back and forth. When I think about Bernie Sanders, you know, I supported Bernie Sanders for president. I supported Bernie Sanders for president in 2016. I was a delegate for him both times. Something that I really appreciated about Bernie Sanders in the Rise and Organize, Maine Dems did a virtual convention rally. And Bernie Sanders showed up and gave a speech about racial justice that was really hit the nail on the head. It was inspiring to me. And at that point, you know, it was already clear that he was not going to be our nominee. And it was sort of bittersweet because what happened next was Joe Biden pulled out of the rally and gave a sort of text scrolling, no audio speech, basically blaming protesters for causing damage to communities. And that stark contrast was really difficult for me to rectify, especially considering that Bernie Sanders says, you know, vote Joe Biden. I'm having a lot of difficulty, candidly, accepting Joe Biden as a candidate. You know, I recognize that our priority has to be getting Trump out of office. He is dangerous. And also, Joe Biden has a credible accusation of sexual assault that has not been investigated. His track record on racial justice is does not meet this moment. So when you think about differentiating from Bernie Sanders, I think I'm a little less willing to compromise. And okay. I am still looking for better solutions.
Bree, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. That was Bree Kidman. She is running to be the Democratic nominee candidate for U.S. Senate.
In the weather today, partly sunny in the northern half of the state and down east, partly cloudy for the remainder. Drier for all and 70s for most, 80 to 85 degrees Brunswick west and south. Then tonight, partly cloudy statewide, 48 degrees in the mountain hollows to low 60s, Portland south along the coast. And tomorrow, partly sunny with numerous midday and afternoon light showers inland. 70s in the north, mountains and down east, and 80 to 85 for the remainder.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
I moved to Maine on my 23rd birthday. To me, it was starting over. It was a rebirth. It was reinventing myself. Living in Maine has allowed me to find myself and find my art and find my purpose as an artist. It's such a creative, vibrant environment. There's so much to be inspired by here in Maine. The nature, the scenery, I love traveling, I love visiting other places, but I love coming back to Maine. I'm Maria Castellano-Ursary. I live in Brunswick, and this is my Maine.
This is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
As institutions everywhere confront structural racism and inequality, medicine is no different. Only 5% of American physicians are Black, which can affect the care Black patients receive.
If you're not understanding the impact of being Black on them and on their mental health, you're doing a disservice to them, and I don't know how you can treat them effectively.
The challenges facing young Black physicians this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's coming up later today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by AARP Maine, advocating on the issues that matter to Mainers over 50 and their families. AARP.org/ME. The Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, a statewide practice representing injured and disabled Mainers since 1974. JoeBornstein.com. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management, and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. My guest for this half hour is Eric Brakey. He served two terms in the Maine Senate and is running for the Republican nomination to Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon, Jennifer. Glad to be on with you.
And I need to mention you are joining us by Skype. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Eric Brakey, why are you running for Congress?
Well, I'm running for Congress because I believe in a free Maine and a free America. And I'm the only candidate in this race, in this Republican primary, with a track record of getting the job done. In the Maine Senate, I got the job done with constitutional carry, getting our Second Amendment rights back. Now no Maine person who is a law-abiding citizen needs a permission slip from government to exercise their right to defend themselves and their families. I got the job done with welfare reform as the Senate chairman for the Health and Human Services Committee, banning the purchase of alcohol, cigarettes, and lottery tickets from being purchased with our tax dollars, making sure that our limited social safety net resources are going towards what they're supposed to go towards, giving people a hand up, not a hand out. And I got the job done with getting our health care freedoms back with Right to Try, so that terminally ill patients don't need to beg for permission from federal bureaucrats to try investigational medicines to try to save their own lives. So I'm the only candidate in this race with a track record of not only being a strong, principled freedom conservative, but also, when it comes down to it, getting the job done, actually getting proven results for Maine people. And I think, considering the big challenges we have in Washington, D.C. right now, where our economy is on shaky ground, our healthcare system is broken, our gun rights are under attack constantly by Michael Bloomberg and others, and our active duty men and women in uniform have been deployed overseas in wars that go on for decades and never seem to come to an end, with no clear mission and no end in sight. I think that we need a proven freedom conservative who gets the job done. And that's who I am.
Eric, if you're elected to Congress, what will be your number one issue when you get to Washington come January?
Well, it's hard to pick just one. So let me talk about one of the issues that I've been really pushing very hard in this campaign, which is my plan for how we fix healthcare by firing the bureaucrats and putting doctors and patients back in charge. You know, right now, when you look at our healthcare system, a full third of the price of healthcare is the cost of bureaucracy. When we complain that healthcare is too expensive, it's not because we're paying doctors too much, it's because we're paying bureaucrats too much. That's why I've been working with local doctors here in the state of Maine to develop a plan to personalize healthcare. Fire the bureaucrats, put doctors and patients back in charge, and I'm the only candidate in this race with a plan to fix healthcare. Jared Golden, of course, has a different plan. He wants to socialize healthcare. He's there with Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on putting Washington, D.C. in complete control of our healthcare system. But I want to put people in charge.
All right. As you know, big conversation right now about criminal justice reform. Do you believe there need to be major reforms in the criminal justice system? And if so, what do you believe needs to happen?
Well, a few points let me make. Short answer to your question is yes. In fact, in the Maine Senate, I led the charge for criminal justice reform. I sponsored legislation to make it so that those who've committed certain nonviolent crimes could get their records expunged after serving their time and being out on good behavior for 5 years. I sponsored legislation to look at how we can reform our pretrial system, because we have so many people behind bars in our jails. Our jails are incredibly overcrowded, and so many people are there who may be there because they can't come up with $50 in bail money. And so they sit there day after day after day, and they end up just pleading guilty and taking time served, whether they actually, you know, committed what they're accused of or not. So our criminal justice system does have some real problems. But I do want to acknowledge in this conversation how fortunate we are here in Maine, because I believe that our law enforcement officers here in Maine, I've lived in different parts of the country, and the law enforcement officers we have here in Maine, I truly believe are among the best in America, with among the strongest culture of respect for the individual constitutional rights of the people that they protect and serve than I've seen anywhere else in the country. So in many ways, I think that Maine can serve as a model for the rest of America. I think that there are things that we do here. For example, we have strong protections in place to protect against some of the policing for profit models that happens with abuses of civil asset forfeiture in other parts of the country. I think some of the things we do here in Maine, for example, prohibiting civil asset forfeiture funds from going into local police coffers. That's something that should be a model for the rest of America. But when we look at specifically what has happened in recent weeks and recent months, of course, we know the story of George Floyd and what happened there, and that was absolutely unacceptable. And the officers involved with that should lose their jobs and should probably be prosecuted for what happened there. And sadly, that's not an isolated incident. We've also seen, you have the case of Breonna Taylor in Kentucky, an innocent woman, an African-American woman, who was the victim of a no-knock raid. She was shot dead in her own home. And in Maryland, a very similar case. In this case, a young Caucasian man was the victim of a no-knock raid and shot dead in his own home. So these are problems that whether you're white or black or whatever, these are problems that can affect all of us. And so one thing that I absolutely think we should do on the federal level is I support Senator Rand Paul's bill for a complete ban on no-knock raids. I think that they have led to far too many tragedies, and this is something that should be ended completely. And then also, of course, you have the case of the police officer who killed George Floyd. He had a bad track record of misconduct, and he was never held accountable. So there's this, people say there's a few rotten apples. Well, and I think there's certain truth to that. But if there are rotten apples, we need to actually get rid of the rotten apples. And the problem is that there is not accountability in some of these systems. The rotten apples just get passed along and continue on in the system. So we need to make sure that individuals like him who abuse the power that we entrust them with are removed from that position of power, are never allowed to have that badge again, and so they don't cast a shadow over all of our law enforcement.
Eric, you opposed the coronavirus relief package passed in late March, calling it, quote, a rotten deal for Maine people. Did you oppose the unemployment payments or the PPP program for businesses?
So the overall package, we've got to look at that overall package. Of course, there are many things in there, and some things may be better than others. But the overall package was a very rotten deal. And the best thing to have done would have been to not shut down the economy in the first place. If you didn't shut down the economy in the first place, you wouldn't have needed to bail out all these businesses. So frankly, we shouldn't have shut down our economy. These lockdowns and shutdowns have proven to be completely ineffective at stopping the spread of the coronavirus. You look at states that shut down versus states that didn't shut down, and there is no consistency in terms of spikes of coronavirus. So it has not been an evidence-based practice. We've really cut off our nose to spite our face there. So if we hadn't shut down the economy, we wouldn't have needed these trillions of dollars in federal spending. But on top of that, where does the money come from? So they're giving out, $1,200 to every American. Well, when you look at the actual cost, it's much more like every American is paying in at least, $8,000 for what's being paid out. So we pay in $8,000 and we get $1,200 back. Well, where's the rest of it going? It's going to well-connected, politically well-connected, big business, big special interests, and we're paying for it. We're paying for it as they print trillions of dollars out of thin air at the Federal Reserve. When they print these trillions of dollars, the value comes out of every dollar already in circulation. They're stealing our savings. So those who are saving for retirement, those who are saving for their kids' college fund, that's where they're getting this money from. They're stealing the value of your savings. They're attacking the middle class. And so, yes, it was a very rotten deal. I opposed it, and I especially oppose the biggest spending package in all of human civilization. A spending package this big has never been passed before, all of human civilization. And it went through the House of Representatives without a vote of Congress, based on Nancy Pelosi's say-so alone. And both of my Republican primary opponents think that that's okay. That's not how we're supposed to do things in America. We elect people to vote on these things so that we can hold people accountable if they're not being accountable for what we expect them to do.
We'll go to Laurel, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Laurel. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. Eric, I've been hearing the other candidates in your race talk a lot about supporting Trump. I support Trump. I've supported Trump a long time. But I haven't heard a lot about the actual policies that they intend to support when they get to D.C. Do you have more specifics there that you could offer than a general, I support Trump?
Well, of course, I support the president because I support, for the most part, his policies. I think at the end of the day, the president and I have different, you know, styles and rhetoric, but I think at the end of the day, actions speak louder than words. And I support, I especially support the America First agenda. And let me break down what I mean by the America First agenda. By the America First agenda, I mean opposing these never-ending wars that have gone on for decades. We've thrown our soldiers into conflicts with no clear mission and no end in sight. And President Trump is the first president in my lifetime to say, is this really in America's interest? Is it really in our interest to be in Afghanistan 20 years later? Is it really in our interest to still be in Iraq and in Obama's failed unconstitutional war in Syria? So that's why I support the president, because of the policies. And so I'm going to when I get to Congress, I'm going to be supporting President Trump on standing up for our soldiers, getting them a clear mission or a plane ride home to their families. I'm sure there are plenty of other policies I could talk about, but that's one very specific reason why I support the president.
Laurel, thanks for your question. Jason on Facebook asks, do you think that literally shooting a flamethrower at a figurative opposition is a good way to send a message? He's referring to a Facebook ad that you have of you firing a flamethrower. He follows it up by saying, do you think violence is the answer to problems? Because it sure looks like this is how you feel.
To the person making that comment, I would suggest maybe they need to get a little bit more of a sense of humor, because that was it was a fun thing that we did. I was at Northeastern Firearms, and they gave me the opportunity to fire a flamethrower. And who wouldn't take up the opportunity to fire a flamethrower? We caught some video of it, and we put it up there. And frankly, I think in comparison to Jared Golden's ad last year, where he literally aimed a rifle at Bruce Poliquin's face, I think that this was pretty tame by comparison. So, but you know what? It was a fun thing. The response to it on Facebook was pretty much universally positive. People had a good laugh about it. We need to be able to take a joke every now and again. And at the end of the day, I think black flies are serious business here in Maine, and maybe we could all use a flamethrower to deal with them from time to time.
Mim on Facebook writes, being married to a Vietnam veteran, I am concerned for our troops in Afghanistan. Some of these soldiers have served two or three tours, many returning with PTSD and severe injuries. How do you intend to address this situation when you are a member of Congress?
Well, first, we need to get our troops home. When we went over to Afghanistan, we went over there for a very good reason. We were attacked on 9/11. And thanks to our soldiers who've done their job, Osama bin Laden is dead. Every co-conspirator who conspired with him is either in U.S. custody or in the ground. And that is the accomplishment of our soldiers, and I'm very proud of them for what they did for us, for all Americans. And yet they've been left behind in Afghanistan. Administration after administration after administration, President Trump is the first one to try to end this war and bring them home. We need to understand that Afghanistan has been called the graveyard of empires. Alexander the Great couldn't conquer Afghanistan. The Soviet Union could not conquer Afghanistan, and we're not going to be able to conquer Afghanistan. This idea, the mission changed. It went from a mission of justice to a mission of nation building, and we're not going to be able to turn Afghanistan into Vermont. We're not going to be able to take the Cliff Notes versions of Western civilization and just airdrop it there and expect everything to be great. This is a very tribal society. People have been warring with each other for thousands of years, and we're not going to be able to change that. So, I think the mission was accomplished in Afghanistan a long time ago. I think that it's time to bring our soldiers home. And when we do bring them home, because many of them do struggle with PTSD and many complications from their service there, and they come to a very broken VA system that is more accountable and responsive to the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. than our veterans who they're supposed to be serving, we need reform there. I've been talking with some local veterans here in Maine who've suggested an idea that I think is a great one, which is to return to the model of the VA that we had before World War I, which is where it was an organization where the veterans actually voted on who was in charge of the VA, and the VA was accountable to them. So that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to put veterans in charge of our VA once again.
All right. I'm going to go to voicemail from Mark in Lewiston. We're unable to play the clip of the voicemail, but what Mark wants to know is what you think about the Bath Ironworks strike and how you view unions in general.
Yeah, I think that unions play a very important role. I think I believe that people have the right to negotiate for the best deal possible. I also think that, you know, union membership should be voluntary, but unions should be able to make the case to workers on the value that they provide. And when we look specifically at what is going on at BIW right now, I think that the workers there have the absolute right to negotiate for the best deal possible. And I hope that all parties, both BIW and the workers there, will come to the table in good faith and hammer out a deal as quickly as possible, because there's a lot at stake right now. I know that Bath Ironworks is about 6 months behind on delivering its contracts. There has been concern on the federal level whether or not we're going to continue to receive contracts. And so we've got to get this figured out quickly, because Bath Ironworks is the last great shipyard in Maine. We used to be known, I mean, Maine has always been known for shipbuilding. We used to have many great shipyards in Maine. BIW is the last one. And I want to make sure that Bath-built ships continue leaving Maine for generations to come.
Daniel on Facebook writes, I'm a lifelong libertarian, which means I believe some liberal ideas, such as freedom to marry, but also conservative ideas, such as freedom to buy guns. How does this translate in your Republican platform?
Well, I think that liberty is ultimately the basis of our country and our state. For generations and generations, Maine people have been fighting for freedom. I mean, that's what it's been. We're celebrating 200 years, actually, of freedom and independence from Massachusetts when we kicked them out after they wouldn't defend us during the British occupation of 1814. So that's what I fight for. I fight for freedom, for our right to make our own choices in our own lives, so long as we're not hurting other people, and to keep the fruits of our labor. I think it's as simple as that. Government exists to do some very basic things. As Thomas Jefferson put it, to protect life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that's what I'd like to see us stick to.
We'll go to Dexter, who's calling from Oxford. Hi, Dexter. Go ahead.
Hi. So, Eric, you were a champion for constitutional carry in Maine. My question is, how do you plan to continue expanding our Second Amendment rights once you're in Congress, and why are you the most effective person to get that job done?
Well, I appreciate the question, and you raise a very good point. Of the candidates in this race for Congress, if you support the Second Amendment, I am the only candidate with a track record of getting the job done for the Second Amendment. Not only did we pass constitutional carry in a time of divided government, when Democrats controlled the House and Republicans controlled the Senate, and we got that done because I didn't go to the politicians and ask nicely. I went to people's constituents and got them to demand their politicians to pass constitutional carry, and that's how we got it done. And that's frankly how we've gotten everything done when it comes to the Second Amendment. When Michael Bloomberg started pushing his money into Maine, trying to push red flag gun confiscation orders, which would allow government agents to seize firearms from law-abiding people with no due process at all and no notice. The only notice you'd get is the knock on your door early in the morning, as some people in other states have found. We defeated that because even when Democrats were in charge of everything, because again, we went to their constituents. We got people calling and emailing and showing up in Augusta and letting their elected officials know that if they voted to take away our Second Amendment rights, our constitutional rights, that they'd be out of a job come reelection season. And that's how I'm going to be effective in Washington, D.C. I'm not going to be just going to the other congressmen and asking them nicely to uphold our Constitution. I'm going to be tapping into networks of freedom-loving people across Maine and across America to hold the politicians accountable. That's the only way we get our Constitution back.
Dexter, thanks for your call. You're talking a lot about freedoms. Eric, I'm wondering if you believe wearing a mask in public is a matter of freedom or a matter of being a good citizen and protecting other citizens.
Well, I think it's a personal choice. I will say, you know, when I'm going into a crowded environment, particularly an indoor environment, I tend to wear a mask just out of respect for others. But when I'm walking around outside in the sunlight is a big disinfectant. I try to maintain social distance, but I don't feel the need to wear a mask if I'm outside and staying at least 6 feet away from people. So I think that should be a personal choice. And I also think that at the end of the day, you know, I was talking with Sheriff Eric Sampson here in Androscoggin County. And I think he had an observation on the lockdowns, and I think it's a very similar observation, too, about masks. He said, you know, when the lockdowns are when it was suggested that people stay inside, and people tended to stay inside. But when it became mandatory that people stay inside, they stopped doing it. And I think the same is true with masks. If masks are such a good idea, and frankly, so many in the medical establishment can't seem to agree with each other, the World Health Organization says don't wear masks. The Surgeon General says don't wear masks, but some other health officials say do wear masks. So there is no consensus on this. But if it's such a good idea, you need to make the case to the people on why it's something that people should voluntarily adopt. Because once you start passing mandates and telling it is something that people have to do, we're freedom-loving Maine people. We don't take so kindly to people telling us what we have to do. So make the case, trust our own intelligence to be able to make our own choices, but you're going to find that once you start putting mandates and telling us what we have to do, people aren't going to be so compliant with that. That's not in our nature.
An email from Sarah. What is your foreign policy stance? Do you support renewing the Patriot Act?
I absolutely oppose the Patriot Act. In fact, in the Maine Senate, I sponsored legislation called the Fourth Amendment Protection Act, which I won support on from both Republicans and Democrats, to say that the state of Maine would not cooperate with these illegal, unconstitutional surveillance policies from the federal level. I believe the Patriot Act should be repealed. I think it is a gross violation of the Fourth Amendment. And I think that we and Republicans now, I mean, I've been saying this for years. Sometimes I've been a minority in my party saying this, but I think Republicans now are realizing how much these powers can be abused when we've seen how they've been abused against our own president and his administration, as you've had corrupt officials in the FBI abuse the FISA courts to get warrants to spy on people around the president and his campaign and his administration. So I think finally many people in my party are finally ready to have this conversation, and I'm going to lead the charge in Washington, D.C., to get the Patriot Act repealed and to restore our Fourth Amendment.
Diana on Facebook writes, Maine has one of the oldest populations in the nation. Immigrants from various countries have moved here and now help support our state as taxpayers and workers in integral industries such as healthcare. Mr. Brakey's anti-immigration rhetoric is hurtful to the millions of immigrants who are the backbone of this country. Why is Eric Brakey anti-immigration when immigrants are the people who are keeping our economy going?
Well, it certainly doesn't sound like that person has a perspective. let's talk about this. I draw a distinction when we're talking about immigration. I draw a distinction between those who are coming here legally, those who are coming here to work and contribute and earn the American dream. I mean, that's what it says on our Statue of Liberty. Give us your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, not yearning for free health care, yearning to breathe free. America is about freedom, not free stuff. The problem that I've had with the way our systems are set up goes back to what Nobel Prize winning economist Milton Friedman said many years ago. He said, it's just obvious you can't have open borders and a welfare state. Right now, we seem to be pushing in both directions. We are always expanding welfare benefits and saying that anyone from around the world can come here and sign up for benefits on day one. That's not what America is supposed to be about, and it's going to draw the wrong kind of immigration to America. If people want to come and work and contribute, that's great and wonderful. That's the American dream. If people want to come here for a check and a handout, that's not what America is about. And frankly, as a poor rural state, we've been really experiencing it very, very harshly here. We have limited resources. We struggle to take care of our seniors. We struggle to take care of our adults with intellectual disabilities and autism. We don't have enough resources for them. And yet people can come here, immigrate here, and get on the welfare rolls on day one. I think that we need to have clearer priorities. I think that we need to take care of our most vulnerable first.
An email from Mike. You seem very supportive of Trump's policies. Trump said COVID-19 is a hoax. Do you think the virus is a hoax? And you have a little less than a minute.
I think that that's a misquote of what the president said. He said that some of the response in the media was a hoax. So obviously it's not a hoax. It's a real virus that exists. But we should have a balanced and nuanced approach for how we handle it. Janet Mills has been taking a sledgehammer to our economy. I think that we need a scalpel, a much more targeted approach to protect our most vulnerable, those with underlying health conditions, those who are our seniors, and let the vast majority of free, young, healthy people live their lives. And that's how we're going to defeat this virus.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Eric Brakey is one of three candidates vying for the Republican nomination for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling will be rebroadcast at 7 this evening. It is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. You can find past editions of our program as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. All of the Maine Calling Your Vote 2020 candidate interviews can be found on the Maine Public website. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.